All right. So thank you all for being here. I've been really inspired by the past couple weeks of talks, and I thought I'd talk about mostly new stuff from my postdoc today that I think would be sort of incredibly relevant to this audience. And so basically, I became fascinated at the beginning of my postdoc with signaling dynamics, and specifically those of the Earth pathway. And I spent a large portion of my time just trying to wrap my head around what those signaling dynamics do to cells, and how cells, if they do at all, can regulate and modulate those dynamics. Okay? So that's what today's talk is going to be about. So I started. Let's see. Is that going? Good. Okay. So I started actually my journey in science as a sort of bacterial biophysicist. And so the way I approached the signaling problem, I think, is a little bit non-traditional, but I did it in comparison to or grounded in what I knew of how bacteria transmit information to their genomes. And if you look at a plot of the number of protein coding gene, a genome of a bacteria, and you plot that against the number of two-component signal transduction pathways, which are basically the only way that, or one of the main ways that bacteria transmit signals to the genome, you can see that there's almost this nice linear relationship where the more proteins, the more things that a bacteria can do, the more sort of wires it needs to transmit environmental information to those activities. And I was completely shocked when I generously plotted a human on this plot. Right? So I think if generously humans probably have 20 to 50 signaling pathways that we know of and are well characterized. Obviously, they have way more genes than bacteria. And so there's this sort of information transmission disparity, if you think about it from a signaling perspective.
Yeah. So from your perspective, what constitutes a signal transduction pathway? Is that something from a signal to a particular type of protein receptor all the way down, or what would make?
Yeah. So I would say just so you see these sort of hourglass shape diagrams when you plot the connectivity of these networks, and so there can be multiple receptors feeding into a single pathway, and then it fans out again to multiple different outputs. And the same thing occurs in bacteria, although there's much less of a fan at the receptor level than in humans.
So you're talking about the constriction of the hourglass.
Yes, exactly. The number of like dedicated wires or information transmission channels to get information to the genome. Right. Yes?
Do you know of any examples that are like the opposite of human, where they have very few proteins and a lot of signaling pathways?
No. Yeah. Okay. And so what I think that this implies or immediately suggests is that, of course, signaling pathways in a human are doing a lot of things. And so there's one pathway that I think in particular exemplifies this, and that's the RAS-ERK pathway. And so it's sort of famously involved, or so it's a kinase cascade where RAS phosphorylates RAF, which phosphorylates MEK, which phosphorylates ERK. ERK, you know, goes into the nucleus and causes genes to get turned on, and then causes a cellular behavior to be executed. And it's sort of famously involved in every cell behavior you can possibly think of, really. So it's really classically known for its role in proliferation and controlling the cell cycle. It's been shown to like upregulate apoptosis in certain situations. It's a key player in cellular differentiation, in adhesion, and even in things like learning and memory. And I should also say, for the aficionados, that actually many of the exact same downstream genes from ERK are actually upregulated in all of these processes when ERK is activated. So it's a really interesting mystery. And what I think it begs the question of, how does a single pathway control or regulate so many outcomes? So it sort of suggests that there might be some mechanism by which this pathway could multiplex information using a single channel. So there were two sort of predominant hypotheses to date. Maybe a couple more for how this multiplexing happens. The first one is the idea of combinatorial decoding. So that idea is simply that the RAS-Src pathway, in conjunction with the activity or inactivity of another pathway, is sort of computed in some logical function, like think about an AND gate, and it's the difference in these activity, the sets of activity states of these pathways that determine two, you know, different cell fates. But a much newer hypothesis, which I've been like totally obsessed with, is this idea that there can be this dynamic encoding of information in the pathway. And so that idea is that different time-varying signals through the same channel can result in different cellular outcomes. And that sort of hypothesizes or posits that there's this dynamic decoding module sort of downstream of the RAS-Src pathway that can interpret the differences in those signals. But there wasn't very much evidence for this, and really, you know, the field of molecular biology was sort of reared on Western blots and signaling biology in particular, and so Western blots classically average out population signals, and so if the dynamics in any single cell aren't, or any set of cells aren't completely synchronized, you would miss them. And so I think this whole idea was totally underappreciated until the advent of fluorescent proteins in single cell fluorescent microscopy.
You think of these as mutually exclusive?
No, not at all. And I can talk to you at length about that and maybe some examples today. When I started my postdoc, I sort of dug into the literature to see what examples of what piece of data might suggest that this is a possibility. And found the very first reported found the very first reported piece of data that there are dynamics in the ERK pathway, which was by this excellent paper by Stephen Wiley, where they simply GFP tagged ERK, and they saw that it sort of had these well-defined periodic oscillations of it going in and out of the nucleus. And one of the so this was really interesting, but one of the sort of caveats to this experiment is it only happened if these cells were grown in a very particular way. So it only happened if they had a certain amount of EGF, a growth factor in the media, and it only happened at certain cell densities. And so, you know, there were many arguments that maybe this experiment was just like tweaking the molecular network to a position that it oscillated, to a place in like sort of state space where it oscillated, and that this wasn't actually what cells were doing in vivo. And then I think the most compelling piece of data showing ERK dynamics in vivo came out to date, which was this. Let's see. Okay. So the Matsuda lab from Japan created an ERK fret sensor. So this molecule that would fluoresce upon the activity of ERK, and they actually put it, they genetically modified a mouse to express it in every cell. And what they did was they were able to lay this mouse's ear down onto a coverslip, still attached to a fully living mouse, and they wounded the edge, they wounded the ear, and what they saw were traveling waves of ERK activity emanating from the edge of the wound. And so this became pretty clear that ERK dynamics and even spatial patterns had some regulatory organizing role in cell decisions. And so I thought it would be interesting to go ahead and figure out how I could isolate the dynamics from the combinations and also systematically vary the dynamics in order to see if these features, signal features, actually carried any information. So in order to do that, I, oh yes?
Can
But is it known or hypothesized what those cells away from the wound are deciding on?
Yeah, so the idea is that they, let me play this, is that they are actually instructed as to the direction of the wound and are migrating in the opposite direction of the wave. So they, it's a way to transmit long range information to cells like way over here about where the wave is. Because the
migration that far away from the wound, not just growth.
They didn't look at it in this particular examples, but others have looked at it in the context of cells on a dish, and there is migration about that far away. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So I was introduced to this incredible toolbox that could perhaps mimic these beautiful, elaborate signaling patterns that we see throughout development, and perhaps could be instructing cell fate decisions. And that is the idea of cellular optogenetics. And I think some of you may be familiar with neuronal optogenetics. And this sort of toolbox operates on the exact same principle, where we have these proteins that in many cases evolved in plants to sense light. And they have chromophores that are like little molecular antenna whose electronic state changes when they absorb a photon. And that results in the protein changing shape around the chromophore, which then plants have evolved to facilitate a binding event to another protein generally, or to itself. So plants, in plants, these things homodimerize, heterodimerize, and oligomerize. And they're used to sense all sorts of environmental light cues and execute important decisions in plant development. And it's sort of been the clever work of optogeneticists to sort of engineer these tools into interesting and useful ways of studying various properties of cell biology. So one part of my lab uses these tools to actually control the phase state of proteins. So we have a huge number of tools actually that can create a diffuse monomer and either clustered into a giant solid aggregate that's reversible, or into a more liquid-like membraneless organelle. And we're using those to try to understand what are the function of these phase-separated globs in cell biology. Today, the tools I'll talk about actually rely on this sort of kind of classic strategy of using the heterodimerization capabilities of tools to drag a protein in basically to any addressable part of the cell. So, one common example and the tool we'll be using today, you can take a protein that's otherwise cytoplasmically localized and drag it to the membrane where its substrates are, for example. Or you could imagine taking a transcription factor and pulling it into the nucleus conditioned on light, and that's also a very common strategy. Okay. So the thing that I think makes this toolkit incredibly powerful, though, is our ability to spatiotemporally pattern light onto cells. So we're like incredibly good at doing that, as a society. This projector is actually chips in these projectors. We like to engineer directly into the light path of our microscope, and so we can just play movies of light onto cells in any arbitrary pattern we want. And that enables us to toggle signaling pathways on temporal scales that we really believe are faster than biology makes any major decisions. So here's an example of a triple negative breast cancer cell line where the signal you're seeing here is that of fluorescently tagged ERK again. And we can just toggle the a tool that activates the ERK pathway on and off, and we can just put ERK in and out of the nucleus. Now we're not directly controlling ERK, we're actually controlling the signaling pathway which releases or localizes ERK as a result of its activity to the nucleus. And so the opto tools switch on the order of milliseconds, and then we're really just diffusion limited as to the having the rest of the pathway be activated. And then one of my friends and postdoc affiliates was also able to take this exact same tool and put it into a fly embryo, and he could, for example, activate ERK in the exact pattern of the word ERK. And so I want you to just appreciate that these are single cells, and we are well below a single cellular resolution. So we're definitely at sort of we're definitely only limited, I think, by the wavelength of light as far as the spatial patterns we can activate on cells. Okay. So going back to this idea of building a tool that could isolate dynamics from combinations, I have embarked on sort of upgrading this sort of classic optogenetic tool, which is based on this heterodimer called the Phi-PIF system. This is a protein from, or two proteins from Arabidopsis. And this tool is rather unique in that it turns on in the presence of red light, but then can be instantly, or essentially instantly deactivated in the presence of infrared light. And the states of, or the memory of these two wavelengths of light can be preserved for days, but it can photo switch thousands of times without any show of decay in its kinetics, and so it has a lot of really interesting properties. So the strategy we took, which was sort of well documented, was to take this catalytic activator of RAS, this core piece of a protein, and recruit it to the membrane in the presence of red light by having PIF bind to Phi, where it would activate RAS, and then we could just release it by adding infrared light. And so that looks like this. This is now you're looking at the IRFP signal from SauceCat, and this would be a cytoplasmic signal. This is membrane signal. I want you to just watch the top left, we're indicating red infrared. I just want you to watch the toggling. So that's an image every like 20 seconds, maybe. So it's really clean, continuous, photo-switchable activation of this pathway. So what I thought the field really needed was a way to track how upstream signaling dynamics were interpreted by downstream genes. And so I envisioned this this sort of cell line where you could watch ERK activity, the direct downstream output of the Opto tool, and then wanted a way that you could look at transcription and translation in perhaps in any gene arbitrarily. And so the sort of solution I devised is this CRISPR tag, which I call a TT tag for transcription translation tag. Basically, all we do is we have a gene, and just before the stop codon of that gene that we're interested in, we have this incredibly fast-folding YFP that we insert. And then downstream of the YFP, we have this set of 24 MS2 repeats. And these MS2 repeats fold when they are transcribed into mRNA into these aptamers, which recruit in this protein called the MCP protein, which binds to MS2, which we tag with mCherry. And then, of course, we can just watch the translation of the protein, with, albeit with a small delay. And we can do this in the exact same cell. So there's the transcriptional focus kind of blinking on and off. And then you can see this cell turning on. Yes?
So you mentioned it's sort of this like hourglass, or some of these signaling pathways are this hourglass thing. And here, I'm not sure exactly where like RAS fits in that hourglass, but is there any way to check if the way you're activating the signal here is like the same sort of mode that exists in cells in vivo, or like maybe it's sort of orthogonal to like the combinations of signals that the cells are actually experiencing? Does that make sense?
Yeah, so yeah, it makes perfect sense. So one of the first experiments we did with this tool, which I don't have here, is we can activate the pathway by adding a growth factor ligand like a PDGF, and with the tool itself. And then we just did RNA-seq at time points post-stimulation. And PDGF stimulation has this stereotyped ERK dynamics that we didn't attempt to mimic with our opto tool. So it sort of peaks at 30 to 40 minutes and then sort of decays off. And that's because the receptors actually get internalized and degraded after they're bound to the ligand. And what we saw was, for the beginning, when the dynamics are about the same, though, when they're sort of maximally activated, our tool, the RNA of our tool is almost identical to the PDGF stimulation. So the downstream genes seem to be responding identically.
But if your hypothesis about like the frequency being important or something is true, then that's not really, like, don't you need to match the timing as well?
Yeah, I think it depends on exactly how precise these things are. So like we can sort of, one possibility is that sort of if you're activated cells above a threshold, then you get basically the same transcription, and then it's the dynamics, the sort of on-off dynamics that may determine cell fate choices. And I actually will show you a lot more data, but yeah, I appreciate that. It's when we initially did those experiments, there weren't these incredibly high temporal resolution fluorescent reporters of ERK activity, which now we have. So it may be something to go back and try to mimic identically. And there were differences. There were some genes that were different, and so there are certainly some open questions there. Yeah.
So Max, just for clarity, in terms of the biology, are you thinking that the temporal encoding of the pathway is up the top at the level of RAS?
Yes.
So that's really the level at which you're trying to model.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and that's right where we're activating it. Yeah, and so there's sort of a classic system where NGF gives you these much longer activation, like three times longer than PDGF, for example. So, yeah.
And the gradient response of the pathway, the morphogen and the light can contract each other in terms of the actual quantitative response?
Yes. Yeah. So we can activate way more than the endogenous pathway.
Subsaturation.
Yes. So yeah, we can match. Yeah. And so actually, just to dig into that a tiny bit, you can change the ratio of red to infrared light, and that sets the sort of equilibrium, the number of RAS molecules that are activated, or number of SOS molecules that are recruited to the membrane. And actually, you can tune the speed at which the equilibrium is reached by tuning the intensity of the light in that ratio.
So lots of pathways have feedback that hits at the level of the ligand or receptor, so you're sort of short-circuiting.
Yeah.
That. So how do you, that's almost certainly important in self-fate decisions and things like that. So how do you think about it?
Yeah, I think that's an advantage for us. So like we can sculpt in even totally unnatural inputs and see like the full range of possible cell fates, maybe not even chained to like what actually happens in development, just really exploring the plasticity of the network. But I think as I'll show you today, feedback is an incredibly common theme in biology, and it exists at almost every level of these pathways. So they're not going to let you, the cell's not going to let you get away with continuously activating it, really. Yes?
So you stressed that you have very fast reporters, but you couldn't tell us how fast. So how fast can you actually see both translation?
So transcription, you mean like after the signal? After we activate ERK, or when?
You have these reports. Yeah. Some characteristic time scale.
So we think that the
whether we're talking 10 seconds.
This probably occurs practically instantly, right? This is just the binding event that limits that.
Instantly.
I mean, okay, seconds, right? So we can fix these cells and try to stain for different pieces of the growing piece of mRNA and see that really young, nascent chains of mRNA are also have this fluorescence. This has a delay of 10 minutes. It's published. Yeah. Okay. So the first sort of experiment that we wanted to do, which got around this ligand-based this receptor-level feedback, was just this continuous activation, as Zarya pointed out. And what we did was CRISPR tagged a panel of these ERK-responsive genes here, and we visualized the transcription in response to this continuous activity of the pathway. And you can see them turn on. And then even though the pathway is continuously activated, they all turn off again at about 100 minutes. So that's what this looks like here. And it was actually kind of remarkable how the peaks of the activity, the peak amount of transcription that we saw was for all of these genes occurred at basically the exact same time, with plus or minus a minute or two. And the negative feedback also seemed to occur at about the same time scale. So we hypothesized that there was some global negative regulator acting at the level of transcription. And it was obviously delayed. And so we considered that delay might be actually translation itself. So to test this.
But how about phosphatase in the pathway of the whole MAP kinase pathway?
Yes. So it could be the delayed translation of a phosphatase, for example. It could also be some delayed post-translational modification on a phosphatase. We believe that it's a phosphatase. I'll show you that in a sec. So anyway, when we add this translation inhibitor cyclohexamide to the cells, you can see that while these bursts come up and go away, these are continuously activated for the entirety of the stimulation. That's what that looks like. And to sort of dig into this mechanism and to test the sort of phosphatase hypothesis, we actually looked at the phospho-ERK immunofluorescence. And when the transcriptional activity of the pathways were about the same, sort of maximally activated, we saw this large amount of nuclear and cytoplasmic phospho-ERK in both conditions, but when they were different, right, in the cyclohexamide condition is still activated by the time the DMSO condition has adapted, we saw that there was this nuclear-specific dephosphorylation of ERK, which actually could be one mechanism for multiplexing in this pathway, which is sort of different regulation in different subcellular compartments. Of the same signaling pathway.
Is the delay sensitive to the intensity of the stimulus?
Yes. So we didn't ever publish that, but it definitely I think it is. Yeah. So basically, I did a few sort of pilot experiments on that. Yeah. And that sort of implies that that there's this. That the activity of ERK is actually creating a phosphatase, which gets transcribed and translated and then inhibits ERK activity. And we actually were able to mutate sites on ERK where this dual specificity phosphatase bind, this DUS binding site, and we could show that we could sort of abrogate or at least dramatically alter that that negative feedback. And so we put all that information into a model where we could have ERK activate these downstream target genes, have this delayed negative feedback, which we were able to recapitulate this adaptation that we saw. And one sort of neat feature of the model was that if we gave well-spaced pulses of ERK activity, that we could continuously activate the gene. So less input gives you more output. And to sort of highlight that, if the pulses were too close together, then we don't get maximal activation. If they're too far apart, you also get non-optimal activation. I kind of like to think of this as like a biological bandpass filter. And so we went back to the bench and tested this hypothesis in all of the genes that we CRISPR tagged, and indeed every gene showed this type of bandpass activity. And so what I'm showing you here is the time between these pulses of ERK, and here is the sort of total output from the transcriptional foci, and you can see that they all peak and then go back down.
They don't all peak at the same place.
Exactly. So that was a really interesting observation. So some the peaks of some genes happened like at an hour difference between pulses than others. And we actually looked into our model to see what parameter evolution might be tuning to do this. And there was a parameter which basically represented promoter affinity in the model, and we could tune a low a sort of a band pass filter all the way into a high pass filter if we adjusted that parameter.
Did you show that a MEK inhibitor would block the apoptotic activity?
Yes, that's been shown. And so this this sort of model that we have built here is that pre-transcriptionally there's some dynamic filtering, and then genes can sort of also selectively respond to the dynamics that the cell is currently experiencing. And that may be a way to have different cell behaviors be executed in response to different dynamics.
Could you just elaborate a little bit on that model? What's the intuition for why promoter affinity and frequency are related?
So yeah, so it's basically this theoretical study, right? So if we change the promoter affinity on any gene, and we vary the time, and we also look at the time that their maximal response as a result of changing the time between these ERK pulses, then we see that we can move the peak output to respond to different sort of bands or frequencies of input.
And what's the intuition? Why?
Why? What do you mean? Like, why do cells do that? Or
no. So why? I can't quite see in my mind.
Okay. Yeah. So if a promoter is much stronger, then it requires much less ERK to be activated. So it actually gets activated earlier. Right. So that would be, so it can react to very small, quick pulses of ERK activity.
So why doesn't that just broaden the peak for high affinity then?
Because that same ERK is also creating this negative feedback.
But if you've got an ensemble of responses in a cell, then are you assuming each? So with that, the negative feedback would be at one gene response.
Right. So the global let me think about this. So I know that when I modeled this, that they all shared the same exact negative feedback. Can I get back to you on that? Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
Wouldn't that make it prediction about the time courses of activation of them, and then like it should be activated quicker, you said?
Yes. So it should. So there are a couple of problems with our experiment that I think limit us. So we have to see transcription, and we can only see it once there are enough fluorophores localized to the position in the genome. So that sort of allows us to only look at maybe the output after it's sort of been, after it's at some peak, right? Or if after it's accumulated maybe a little bit. And and we really only, I didn't go back at the sort of, I think that's the best explanation.
Do a dose response to show that these are actually low in high affinity.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're so. Yeah. We're pushing sort of the limit of our imaging capabilities to see these transcriptional foci, and so it's. I think now we probably could with their new instruments. We probably could. Okay. So So we have this idea that perhaps. cells or individual genes can be filtering different dynamics. And so the next question I sort of had was whether these dynamics can be tuned by cells, and if so, how, and ultimately want to take this all the way to see if they determine cell fates. And so this required two sort of innovations to answer these questions. The first one was the invention of this kinase translocation reporter by Sergey Rigaud and from Marcus Covert's lab. And this is a fluorescent reporter of ERK activity that goes into the nucleus when ERK is off and out when ERK is deactivated. And so you can see what that looks like here. Here are some pulses of ERK activity, and you see it in the nucleus, out and out. And so this you can use very small amounts of light, and so you can image this reporter for hours, if not days. And then the other technical advantage that we developed was we were able to isolate this primary cell type, these mouse keratinocytes, that were incredibly dynamic in nature. And so this is a trace of a mouse keratinocyte ERK activity just pulsing for 24 hours, which you can see. And in fact, they had this sort of steady state oscillatory activity where if we grew them in growth media and then switched them to starvation media, they would their ERK activity would decay, but then quickly become oscillatory again. And the same thing would happen if we grew them in starvation media and switched them to growth. Their ERK activity would spike up, and then they'd become oscillatory again. And so we think of them as sort of having this like idling motor of pulsatile activity.
And if you made the transition slow in time, do you think they would still pulse, or they seem to be rooted? They made a gradual ramp from the start to growth.
I think they would still pulse. Yeah. There's basically nothing that you can do to them to make them ultimately stop pulsing, other than completely inhibiting the pathway.
So they see the level. Somehow.
Yeah. Yeah. So like if the derivative isn't changing, they're still pulsing. Yeah. And so here's an example of some other perturbations we tried in zero, and to give you a sense of what these actually look like. Here's zero growth factor, right, just sort of a wild type or normal standard condition. Here's a decent amount of EGF, and you can see that they just continually are pulsing. And then a totally non-physiological, a ton of EGF, and they still are pulsing. I agree that their baseline is probably a bit higher here.
Can you say something about what the role of ERK signaling is? Is it proliferative, or what does it do to these?
So it's proliferative. It's definitely proliferative, and I'll talk more about that. This is the same, this is the embryonic version of the mouse skin that Matsuda imaged. So we also think it directs migration and is involved in wound healing. Right. So I guess I should say that we would take a embryonic mouse and actually cut the skin off of its back and disassociate it and then grow it in a dish for these experiments. So these are directly from the mouse. I also think that perhaps these cells think that they're maybe in a wound, but because they're not really coupled to each other the way they are in vivo, but that's speculation.
Is there a difference in ERK oscillation with respect to if you use different growth factors?
Is there a difference in ERK?
Oscillation? Different growth factors?
No. So there was only one. So we tried a huge host in these cells, we tried a huge host of ERK altering effects, and actually the sort of the one that actually changed the activity of the pathway the most was not even really growth factor per se, but it was human saliva. And the reason we tested that even was because growth rates and wound healing of skin are much faster in the mouth. That's well documented. So we thought there might be some peptides in there that could actually excite this pathway. So with these two sort of tools in place, we were able to do an epic drug screen to try to find drugs that could modulate or tune the features of these dynamics just to see if they are tunable, if the network sort of allows this. And I could not have done this without the help of an incredible undergrad, Jillian Silbert, and an MD PhD student, Alex Golia. And together, we took a compound library of about 430 kinase inhibitors and arrayed them 50 at a time on these 384 well plates, which allowed us to image one well about every 3 minutes to see a high enough temporal resolution to really characterize the dynamics of these oscillations. And then we built a downstream sort of image processing pipeline where we could extract the dynamics from single cells, and then we had an additional set of algorithms that allowed us to look at the width of a pulse, the prominence of a peak, the frequency of pulses, and the sort of overall activity offset at baseline. And so when we finally extracted all the data, we found three distinct sort of classes of drugs or ways that we could change the activity. And we saw that the first principal component was more or less related to sort of temporal features of the signal. And the second principal component was representing sort of overall activity of the pathway. So things like activity offset and pulse frequency were aligned there. Okay. And so what do these three classes look like? So in comparison to a DMSO control, which you can see here just as standard pulsing, about one pulse, one 20-minute pulse every hour, the first class of drugs were just ones that classically inhibited the ERK pathway. So MEK inhibitors, here's an EGFR inhibitor. We also additionally found things like matrix metalloproteases that inhibit this, which inhibit the cleaving of ligands off the surface of cells. So this was not that unexpected. The second class was really interesting. There were only really two or three drugs in this class, and they were drugs that increased the width of a pulse. And here's what that looks like. This is an example, GDC. All of these drugs are so-called paradox drugs, and they stabilize the dimerization of RAF. And the final drug class, which we thought was incredibly interesting, were these drugs that increased pulse frequency, and there were quite a number of these. And they were highly enriched for drugs that inhibited non-EGFR receptor tyrosine kinases. And we can get into the mechanism of what we think those are doing later. Okay. So the next question we really wanted to check was, how do these dynamics affect proliferation, a very standard sort of cell fate choice that we can look at quite easily and in high throughput.
Max?
Yes?
When you look at the population level, do you see any changes, for example, like in synchrony, or that those drugs do?
No, we don't see any changes in synchrony. I mean, by the time we're imaging these cells, it's perhaps an hour or two after we've added the drug, so maybe they could be synchronized early after drug addition, but I don't know. So in order to look at proliferation, we would take drugs from each classes, add them to cells, wait about a day, and then we can do this standard flow cytometry assay to look at the DNA content in cells. After we've also added something that marks the creation of new DNA, and the cells basically lay out in this histogram where you have cells that haven't divided in this first peak, cells that are in the process of synthesizing new DNA in this shoulder in between peaks, and cells that have undergone a full round of division in this second peak. And so we can kind of see cells that are higher, that are in high proliferation mode here with this high peak and high rate of synthesis, and cells that are in this sort of lower proliferation mode. And what we found was I think really interesting. So we could see that sort of we had this baseline control. When we added EGF, we saw an increase in proliferation as expected. And then when we added these EGF inhibitors or ERK inhibitors, we saw proliferation drop. And when we saw these, when we tried these pulse width modulators, we saw an increase in proliferation. And in complete media, we also saw an increase in proliferation in the presence of many of these drugs that increased ERK frequency. Interestingly, in starvation media, we saw a slightly different result, which was that the pulse width modulators still increased proliferation substantially, but the drugs that increased ERK frequency actually didn't have an effect. So basically we can classify two sort of phenotypes. One is in any sort of environmental condition, the cell will increase its proliferation when it's experiencing one type of ERK dynamics, or these long pulses or wide pulsed ERK dynamics, and with these high frequency drugs, we can see that when these high frequency drugs, they only respond in the presence of other endogenous factors and to proliferate. So we wanted to, the second thing we want to check is, are these dynamics sufficient for altering proliferation? So like these drugs have multiple downstream targets, or there some of them aren't very clean, and so we wanted to plug back in the dynamics alone and see if we could emulate these phenotypes that we saw here. And so that's not trivial, right? So we have to inhibit the receptor and also plug in dynamics downstream of it without disrupting our ability to deliver optogenetic inputs. And we tested a few drugs, but we decided to use just the standard lapatinib, which is a standard EGFR inhibitor. And then we could add optogenetic inputs back in. We actually used a new blue light tool for this, because it was just simpler and cleaner. This is what this looks like. So you can see that we start adding the light, cells start responding. And if we quantify several cells, we can see that we can start to entrain and make them pulse, you know, on command when we add the light. So basically what we wanted to try was emulating these three classes of drugs. So we could emulate the first class trivially by not adding any light. We could see if we could change the class 2 type by increasing the width of pulses. And then we tried two sort of higher frequency inputs, a 10 minutes on, 10 minutes off, and 30 minutes on, 30 minutes off inputs, see if we could test whether these higher frequency inputs would give us this higher frequency drug-like phenotype. And I should just point out that both of these are, on average, higher frequency than the higher frequency pulses than the control, than the DMSO control. And so what we saw was exactly what we saw with the drugs. So in complete media, we saw an increase in proliferation over sort of the baseline off drugs with long pulses and with the higher frequency pulses. And in growth factor free media, we saw only a much more pronounced increase when we increased pulse width, and not so much of an increased proliferation when we increased the frequency. So the way we like to think about this is that dynamics determine where cells are in sort of phenotypic space. So you can so if we look at a plot of sort of the S phase, the amount of proliferation in complete media versus the amount of proliferation in growth factor free media, and we have sort of standard cells, untreated cells here, we can treat them with drugs that alter ERK dynamics that push them into sort of these different phenotypic parts of phenotypic space. So the high frequency drugs will only sort of increase proliferation in the presence of other factors, and the sort of longer pulse width drugs will increase proliferation only or in both situations, whereas obviously not delivering inputs doesn't increase proliferation. And we see the same thing here with light. Questions? Okay. Yes?
Does this take events that is change or just muscles debating?
We didn't look at that. So, we didn't look at that.
So Max,
yeah.
How are you thinking the high frequency signals are synergizing with pre-existing factors? I mean, do you think that the cell sees multiple signals and it just adds it up?
Yeah, so I actually think I would be really curious to go back and you can decouple like the area under the curve from the frequency, from the pulse width, with the right set of inputs, and I think that would be an incredibly interesting experiment. I'm a huge advocate for that experiment. Yes?
Because, I mean, kind of another way you could express this is that growth factors determine whether or not you can respond to high-frequency pulses.
Yes, exactly. And so that gets back to this interplay between combinations and dynamics.
Exactly.
Yeah. So
I mean, I'm thinking all the way through. The most famous example in France of this is people have obsessed for ages about calcium spiking dynamics, which vary hugely. So calcium does everything.
Right.
Spikes dynamically in different ways in different systems, and there's one particular example in the root where a plant is having to distinguish between two different symbionts, not for nodulation or mycorrhization, and the calcium spiking dynamics you get out of those signaling pathways are different despite huge commonality in the upstream components. And for a long time that was considered to be it, and now it turns out that the spiking dynamics are almost irrelevant because there's a simultaneous combinatorial thing that comes around the side. Mm-hmm. And so you can kind of, I think the biological context is super important for how one
absolutely
interprets the results.
Right, and unfortunately, like, there wasn't it's not ever a kind of a clean answer.
It's biology.
Yeah.
This, no, both, plus something else.
Yeah.
That's
all. Yeah. That's why I keep asking the same question about time scales.
Right.
I'm sure you explained, but so high frequency here is so comparable to your first inactivation characteristic time, right?
It's faster. It's faster. These are different cells, right? So so this is like a one pulse, more than one pulse every hour. The pulse width is
well, if it's faster, then the fastest response, but then it's essentially continuous. Like, it can't respond to follow these individual things.
Yes, then it's taking the average, right?
Think of it as,
Yeah, totally. And that's what our sort of our high pass filter regime is, right? It's just sort of on, right?
Well, I guess what I'm trying to understand is whether the difference between the two is that inactivation negative feedback that you explained in the beginning, or is there yet another time scale? Right? There's no reason why there couldn't be some other time scale.
Right.
I don't know how this thing will remember things over an hour, but they have in biology, maybe it can. So are we still talking about just one crossover from high to low, or two? That's my question.
Yeah, I mean, so we tried incredibly hard to tag, MS2 tag, the same genes in this cell line. And this is a primary cell line. It's way more difficult. So like when they have too much DNA, they commit suicide, basically. And they can only undergo a certain number of passages. So Yeah, I think we're wondering the exact same thing. It's just been limited experimentally.
So just on, when you're changing the frequency, you're changing the duration at the same time?
Yeah. So you are. I should say that, so in the first part of this talk, when I did this this bandpass filter experiment, we did the exact same thing where you change the frequency but don't change the total dose, and you get the same outcome. So that's like a true engineer's bandpass filter. We didn't think it was faithful to the biology, though, which is why we ended up showcasing that one.
And that depends on the negative feedback loop.
Yes. Yeah. And in the simulation, the same thing happens. Okay. So you may also these are some really great questions. You may wonder, give me a real example of how I can have a cell or a gene, respond to a long pulse over a short pulse. Like, this is sort of things a lot of you have asked, and there's a common motif in the ERK pathway, which we thought could be conferring this activity. And this project I worked with another undergrad, Pav, on, and we decided to make a set of synthetic genes with only regulatory motifs. So we could take the promoter, the UTRs, or a protein, or a piece of a protein itself, and plug it into our MS2 system and just drop those genes anywhere in the chromosome and just assess the function of certain regulatory motifs. And we have a lot of other, we looked at a ton of genes, but today I just want to talk about this dynamic decoder that we were able to build. So if we use this cool piggyback system, which allows you to sort of randomly insert genes anywhere into the genome, the lentivirus does not work in this system, which took us a long time to figure out. But there you can see we give a pulse of ERK activity. You can see this sort of dazzling sparkle of genes turn on. So in each individual cell here we have, I think in this case we have like 17 or 20 single insertions, which we can visualize. And we can quantify them. And in the same with the system in the same cell, we can watch YFP accumulate. And so what we did was there was this FRA1 degron, which is a ERK responsive stabilization tag, essentially, or degradation tag. So on this gene FRA1, when FRA1 is created, ERK then phosphorylates this piece of the protein, which then stops this degron from being activated. So it's sort of stabilized by long-term ERK activity. And all we did was we just stuck this FRA1 degron in onto YFP, and when you don't have it, when we look at the difference between transient and sustained inputs, we see that they're basically about tracking each other, and when you do, we see this large increase, albeit the total amount of accumulation drops, right? Because the total degradation rate is still increased. Okay. So I'm gonna summarize. I do have some additional topics to chat about if you guys ask. I think we have more time, right? We have a half hour, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let me show you.
Yeah.
But go back to transition. I'm interested in the slide that came up way a long time ago that James commented on about why you don't just increase the width of the band. So when he asked that, I was looking at the
band,
and looked to me like actually you did increase the width of the band.
Okay, so let's go way back.
Sorry, it's way.
No. I think this is an important thing. We should talk about this. I should have reviewed this more carefully. I was focusing on all the new material. I forgot about the old material.
So it kind of seems to me that everybody's getting to the inflection point at about the same moment, and there's different rates of ramp up. And the guy who ramps up earliest on the end actually stays up.
I mean, this gene was hard to image, so as you can see, it's very noisy, so that I wouldn't pay attention to.
And then the one next to it comes up latest and immediately goes away.
You're right. I actually had not noticed that.
But in the model, what I'm assuming you're doing is presumably because you've normalized everything to one.
Yeah, exactly.
And presumably to do that in the model, you have to tune some kind of production parameter.
Yes.
So actually, if you didn't do that, if you kept the production parameter the same, it may well look like more like the top. Because again, if you look at your amplitudes...
Right.
So the high frequency, it looks like it's a short pulse, but it's just because it reaches a higher peak at a...
Yes, exactly. So the steady state, like if you were to keep activating it, is higher, right? And it can be reached faster, yeah. Right. Okay. Yeah.
So when you were looking at the proliferation and you had the fast oscillations and the slow oscillations, yeah. Did you try inhibiting that feedback and seeing if that destroyed that?
So the best tool we have for inhibiting the feedback is this mutant of ERK that is called like the dustless ERK. It's a docking domain mutation where dust can't bind to it. It was discovered in flies, and these keratinocytes are very difficult to CRISPR again, and so we haven't been able to test that. We can try like really blunt tools like sodium orthovanidate, general phosphatase inhibitors, and they seem to just make the cells sick. So I wouldn't trust anything that came from those yet. Okay, let me.
You showed us in the beginning the beautiful wave of calcium in the wounded mouse gene. Yeah. And I'm just curious what the evidence is that the temporal dynamics are important in that system. So I could see that, you know, if things go on and off and they propagate, you're going to get a wave. But is that important? Or is it just important that the signal eventually reach further back into the epithelium?
Yeah, let me think about that. So you're asking basically, do you think the frequency or is the wave purely a mechanism for communicating at long distances?
Yeah, maybe a consequence of, you know, there being negative feedback loop is that it turns off and it looks like a wave, but maybe
yeah.
If you had it on everywhere at the same time, that'd be just fine.
So there has to be some way that the cells know the direction of the wave, and it's been shown that they will orient and migrate in a dish towards where a wave is coming from, whether it's caused by like endogenous ligands being cleaved from one cell and passed to another, or with light, if you paint a wave onto cells.
How do they know which way it's coming from?
The cells?
Yeah,
that's a mystery. That's an open question. Yeah. So they have to be polarized in some way by the wave. Yeah.
So in your original argument, it seemed that non-bacterial cells might have a lot of messages they wanted to send to each other,
yeah.
And you can't find them. I found some of them. Are there other patterns besides, long pulse and a short pulse? Is that, have you tried something like that as a way to create more messages with the same amount?
You know, like more elaborate.
More elaborate patterns than just. Varying frequencies.
So. The short answer is we haven't, but there are other signaling pathways that do also display these dynamics. In most cases, we do see that it's the difference between being sort of continuously activated or having some oscillatory response. So one of the famous examples is P53, where two different types of DNA damage or two different amounts of DNA damage are communicated to the rest of the molecular network by the difference between p53 being continuously activated in the nucleus or having extremely periodic oscillations. And it's the sort of time that there's other features where it's like the amount of time the cells are pulsing, the amount of times it's continuously on, that also dictate the gene response. But I think we're still in the beginning stages of imaging these fluorescent reporters in real sort of organisms. So one of the things I didn't show you is we made tons of this KTR virus, and we were just extracting tissues from mice for weeks, looking for interesting dynamics. And I can say that we did see a lot of weird stuff, right? But you gotta pick something and focus on it.
So far, no Morse code.
Yeah, exactly. I actually think, yeah, so far, no Morse code. I think it's simpler than that.
The dynamic figuring experiment, the amount of ERK in the nucleus, how does it change? Is it
which experiment?
In when you're changing the time between the pulses. You have 20-minute pulses, like pulses, right?
Yeah.
You change the time in between. If you keep the dose constant, would the amount of ERK in the nucleus change?
You keep the dose constant.
Like,
are you saying, does when ERK is?
So how's ERK nuclear localization changing? You change the period in between the phases.
Oh, okay, right. So ERK nuclear localization is actually decoupled from ERK activity, and that's something we learned sort of halfway through this project. And so, I like to think of ERK as sort of a mech KTR. So ERK seems to faithfully track mech activity, which is one step upstream. And there's good evidence for ERK being sort of constitutively docked to mech prior to mech being activated. And but ERK can be activated and in the nucleus, or deactivated and in the nucleus, as you sort of saw with that phospho-ERK experiment that I showed in some of the early slides, in the early slides. Does that answer your question? I mean, it's...
Yeah, just wondering, but if you just change the period between the pulses and the dose is constant, would the signaling pathway equally be active or not? You know, what ends up if the promoter of the target gene you're looking at?
I change the period?
The time between the pulses.
Yeah, so, we didn't look. Yeah, that'd be interesting, yeah.
Do you know anything about what is the role of cytoplasmic ERK? I mean, you're showing us transcriptional targets.
Yeah.
Presumably it has to be in the nucleus to turn those.
Yeah. So.
Doing other things in the cytoplasm.
It's adhesion, I think, is the big one that comes to mind. So it stabilizes adherence junctions. There were some interesting papers where they tried to people tried to target constitutively active ERK to different like organelles. Didn't see much. I would say some sort of interaction at this point with the cytoskeleton that maybe influences its the cell's motility. Yeah.
So these are cells in culture. You don't address what's in the medium, but I'm assuming it's rich medium.
Well, so for the transcription story, the entire thing was starvation media, so free of growth factor, and so we would starve cells prior to the experiment for like 2 to 3 hours, till we saw like the.
I guess what I'm getting to is that because cells are in culture and there's an adaptation, there's insulin. Continuous insulin signaling, right? Because that's how they divide, presumably.
They don't divide in starvation.
Not in that particular time, yeah. But basically that's the cells that basically selected to do that in culture.
The cells that we are working with are almost continuously passaged in the presence of, serum, right? With this huge mix of growth factors.
I guess what I'm hearing too is that what do you think will be the relationship between the amplitude of responses you see in these conditions versus, let's say, a more physiological context? That is going to be bigger, smaller? What was your?
So right. So I think if you compare, so we looked. So the first part of the talk, we used the cell line called NIH3T3s, which is a highly domesticated cell line. It's been around for a long time. The second part of the talk was using a primary cell that we would take out of the mouse's skin days before, and the ERK dynamics were stronger, much more elaborate. We did see some ERK dynamics in the NIH3T3s, but they were sort of slower, less well-defined, lower amplitudes. So I think if there's any sort of selection, it's selecting away these elaborate patterns. Yeah. Yes?
You may have already said this, but in the situation where you have the waves traveling,
yeah,
is the like length scale of the ERK ligand diffusion like smaller than the cell, the sort of distance that cells respond?
Yeah.
And sorry, second.
Yeah.
If you just make like a static spatial gradient using optogenetics, do you see any migration of the cells in that?
Yeah. So the answer to the second question is we haven't tried, and we're really excited to do that experiment. The answer to the first question is I think the length scales are about the same, although there's been some thought that they're sort of almost like a synapse of between the two cells where the ligands don't actually diffuse beyond just to the neighboring cell that they're next to, and so they're creating enough. So the waves that you see are not because of ligands, I believe, sort of waves of actual ligands, right? I think they're waves of signaling, and the ligands are sort of one step in communicating.
And that signal is because downstream of ERK, it expresses the ligand? Like the signaling pathway activates
the ligand? Yes. So the signaling pathway, we think, causes the ligand to be cleaved off of the surface. It's already made and hanging there, and then a protease cuts it off in response to ERK activity. And the evidence we have for that is if we add these matrix metalloprotease inhibitors, we get no pulses. Okay? All right. Let me show you one more cool thing. So I just wanted to show you this wild experiment. So like biology has these incredibly complex, rich inputs. So there was some question as to whether any of these changes we were making to the cell were relevant at all. And we finally found this condition where we could increase the pulse frequency and the pulse width with human saliva. And I ended up contacting the one person in the world who studies the peptides in human saliva, who's a Norwegian doctor, and he extracts them from the mouths of children because they're creating so much more than an adult, they have better healing capacity. And when we added this to the keratinocytes, we saw insanely dynamic activity. So you can see that they're on much more, and they're also pulsing much more frequently. And so I just wanted to put this in your head that we're trying to isolate single inputs and see what they do to cells, when in reality the cells are giving, in their environment, they're having these incredibly complex inputs. And so I'm not even really sure how to address this issue, but I thought it would be instructive. Okay.
Sorry, so along those lines, would you have an in vivo model, like ideally an entire organism, or failing that, an actual functioning organ, where one of its ERK pathway members was modified in such a way that they would recapitulate some of the altered or shifted or whatever dynamics that you can see in these conditions, and see if they had an impact on the function of the organ?
Yeah, so I think the best example of this is there is a mutation in BRAF that increases the width of a pulse. And so, and this is common in multiple types of liver cancer. There was a great paper done by Wendell Lim's lab, and this the first author is Lucas Bugai in 2018, where they could take a small, like the 20-minute pulse, with light, deliver it to these cancers and then see that they would be sort of transmuted into this long pulse with the decay. So there was some idea that if you had a tumor, it was sitting, and this is highly speculative, but in sort of a standard signaling environment and a wave of ERK activity hit it, then the wave would slow way down in the tumor and take much longer to decay, and that's how it could increase its, you know, proliferation activity.
The organism that's homozygous for this mutation is dead,
it would have to be that it's just essentially, I don't know. I will say I don't know. Yeah.
Kind of looping back to the beginning, your plots of protein number versus pathway number are kind of interesting. Obviously, there are all kinds of caveats about what constitutes a pathway.
Yeah.
Have you tried to fill in the stuff in between? Have you got yeast and some other stuff?
No, I've been asked that before. I think it would be really interesting. One of the problems, one of the caveats, is like, how do you define a pathway in a eukaryote? It becomes much harder.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So.
But you can interpret it, either you can say that the bacterial cell doesn't care about signal integration very much, which clearly at some level is nonsense because there's lots of well-known signal integration mechanisms in bacteria, but nonetheless, you're just sensing everything separately. But from an evolution point of view, it's kind of interesting to think about essentially loss of stuff. And one interpretation for that is integration becomes way more important in some way. And so you need to then funnel everything through the same pore.
Right.
It's all a bit, it's a bit one of those Neffert-Girard waffly arguments that isn't very satisfying, but it's interesting to think about. I'm curious whether other people wanted to comment on that.
I think it's definitely very interesting, and then you also want to make sure that you're correcting for the evolutionary process and for phylogenetic relationships. Bacteria dwarf all other cellular life in terms of species, number, biomass, radiations, time, and so you may actually not expect anything different than that initial plot that you plotted there, given the
sort of fewer contingencies.
The null hypothesis would be totally different for lineage of bacterial trajectory versus eukaryotes, for example. So perhaps that plot is not outside what you expect at all.
Right.
We don't know, I guess. It'd be interesting to put it together.
Yeah. Okay. So thank you all.